La
la la la la la la
la
la la la la la la la
la
la la la la la la la
la
la la la la la la la la la.
Thank you. Oh, you can stop now. Really, that's quite enough. Yes, I've got my ass covered. You can stop kissing, please. Thank you for being here. I'm Wink Harris, and tonight we have a very special guest here on After the 15th Minute, the show that dares to ask, where are they now? Are they robbing liquor stores? Are they making pornographic videos? Can you find them in the Megan's Law database? Well, we here are only too happy to talk with the has-beens, the lowlifes, and the hardened criminals that once charmed your short attention spans and once touched your onyx hearts. And tonight is no exception. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm pleased to introduce the shock jock before he could shock, the former king of the airwaves, Mr. Bat Segundo!
Hello? Who is this? Jorge, what's going on? Am I supposed to strip?
No, Mr. Segundo. Actually, can I call you Bat?
You can call me that if you promise to buy me a drink. Look, who are you?
My name is Wink Harris, and I understand you once had a promising radio career.
Yes, I did, but what business is that of yours?
It's the business of anyone who subscribes to People Magazine. Perhaps we should remind our audience exactly where you came from. Hal, roll the clip.
Hot, 98.1.
Hello, kids. Bat Segundo here, and I'll keep playing them if you keep calling in and requesting them. It's Tuesday morning, and while I have no business with the Big Gipper, that's Gipper with a capital G, I'd sure hate to be one of those pesky Marxists in Grenada. So let's pick up the patriotism with a healthy dose of Leo Sayer's driving beats.
Now, Bat, that wasn't such a bad life, was it?
It's over now. It's in the past. Along with feathered hair, lacquer workers, and Copernican theory. I've moved on.
Yes, you have. Like a bird flying south for the winter. I understand you have an internet show now that you've been doing for the past year.
It's a podcast. A literary podcast that I introduce.
Oh, one of those. The audio answer to the new Coke or the pet rock. Tell me, Bat, how much does this podcast actually pay? You were once carried on 300 stations, as I recall.
Look, if you want to get down to an old media versus new media thing, I may as well just play you our 50th show. As it turns out, our young roving correspondent pursued this very question. Hal, roll clip!
So I am here with a man who I don't think needs much of an introduction. His name is John Updike. This is his 22nd novel, Terrorist. He's the author also of the Rabbit Angstrom Tetralogy, and as well as the Beck books. John, how are you doing today?
Pretty good. Holding up.
Well, first of all, I should note I'm not from Shillington or Ipswich, but I am a literary person, so hopefully that will kind of keep you at ease.
I'm sure it will.
Okay. First off, I wanted to talk about the epigraph of this book. You open with an epigraph from Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Disbelief is more resistant than faith because it is sustained by the senses. Now, while this quote can certainly apply to Ahmad, seeing as how you sort of dwell frequently on the senses in your work, I also got the sense that it might also apply to you as an author because, you know, to your earlier book, The Coup, was a response to Gaddafi. And I was wondering, is Terrorist a response to Bush? To what extent was Terrorist an act of setting your own sort of disbeliefs with the contemporary situation down on paper?
You know, I'm not sure why I chose that epigraph. I was reviewing another book, a late book by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and I reread Of Love and Other Demons and was struck by somehow this. It states in such a bland way that it's easier to disbelieve than to believe because the senses support a disbelief. It's sort of put in this very offhand Latin way. I didn't have Bush too much on my mind. I was really more concerned with the phenomenon of terrorism, especially youthful suicide bombing, of which there's so much. And you wonder how these kids are enlisted, or they flock to enlist according to Al Qaeda. They can't get, you know, they get more than they need, and still do. And that plus maybe the plus the Columbine massacre, or whatever it was, disaster, and other high school massacre plots that have been uncovered, what is it with these teenagers and death, dying, or why is it so apparently easy for some of them?
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Now, I understand, though, before you had a Muslim protagonist that actually, what is now terrorist, originally had a Catholic priest. What made you switch over from Catholic to Muslim?
The idea of the world being full of devils, everybody in it, including you, or a devil trying to take somebody's faith from him, has been with me a while. Mm-hmm. I didn't get anywhere with the Catholic priest idea, but it was there certainly when I tried to think about contemporary terrorism, the late Ayatollah Khomeini coined the phrase the great Satan, who are all seen as Satan, and certainly to my young protagonist, the world is attempting to take his faith from him, and everybody in it is in that sense a kind of devil. Mm-hmm. So the old idea took on new vitality when you put it into an Islamic context.
Gotcha. Well, also, it seems to me that you can also play, you play very much with the notion of God in this book as well, as opposed to the devil. Maybe God was more of your sort of natural kind of focal point, and when you switched things to Muslim, it kind of sort of naturally shifted to that, perhaps? Or?
Well, of course, God plays a part in religion. Indeed, without God, there wouldn't be a religion. And Ahmad is very much convinced that God exists and is quite close to him. There's a haunting verse in the Quran having to do that God is as close as the vein in your neck. And this I came across and several times occurs in the book, that mm-hmm. God is not some remote figure with a flowing robe and white beard, but he is a kind of version of yourself. He is right with you as a sort of brother. I believe Ahmad, who has no flesh and blood brothers, thinks of him as a kind of a brother, almost a twin of the self.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Now, from a perspective, well, actually, before I actually ask you that question, I want to drag in sort of hugging the shore into this conversation. Is the character of Ahmad an effort to sort of ponder a insufficiently famous American? Or?
That's right. I'd forgotten that little series that I was doing. You refer to a brief set of dialogues, maybe a dozen or ten interviews with insufficiently famous Americans, and I think my approach in fiction has generally been to concentrate on the less famous, the otherwise overlooked, the sort of everyman's out there, rather than to deal with special cases of the very rich or the very brilliant or the very beautiful. So in that sense, Ahmad, yes, is one of the insufficiently famous Americans, although he makes a little bid for greater fame in the course of this book and with a different turn, could have become quite famous. But sure, he's one of the more or less overlookable Americans who interest me as specimens of humanity and as embodiments, really, of the major problems that beset all of us. Harry Angstrom, another overlookable American, was all of the changes in politics and in philosophy and in the worldview that science affords us, we're affected by all of these in ways we can hardly articulate, but I want to show the major currents, the big ideas drifting down and affecting the behavior and thought of insufficiently famous Americans.
Well, I suppose it's the fact that these ideas kind of, you know, insufficiently famous Americans act upon them, because I think that this book is possibly one of your most outspoken novels since the Rabbit Angstrom novels, in the sense that you have a lot of sort of number of interesting asides slip into the prose. You have, for example, the new prospects of affordable housing units, where they have them dwindling in size like pieces of paper repeatedly folded, which also reminded me very much of Brewer's economic disintegration. You have many observations on the generation gap between Jack Levy and Ahmad. And you also describe, for example, the endless procession of ghostly suitcase interiors irradiated in unreal colors in the airport x-ray machines. So there seems to me a very real effort on your part not only to sort of, you know, come to terms possibly with your own thoughts on this world we now live in, but also I want to put the question to you, to what extent is Terrorist a post-September 11th novel? Was this a case where you had 5 years of accumulated thoughts that you needed to get out of your system, or?
It certainly is about the post 9/11 America, terrorists, hijackers, disasters, bombs going off were around before 9/11, of course, but 9/11 set one off, and a big one too, in our own territory, in the spiritual capital, in the way of the city, of the country, New York. New York is very important to all of us, even those who've never lived there. So it, I happened to witness it from a distance, and so I felt kind of like I had a little handle or an entree into this disaster. The post 9/11 world is one of heightened security, of concrete barricades in front of all federal buildings or governmental buildings, really. It's of long lines at the airport. It's a world in which New Yorkers especially don't know what might happen next. So it's the original title, I believe, was Land of Fear. I was going to try to write about a fearful land of heightened security where terrorism was always a possibility. But I switched at some point fairly early on. I switched the emphasis away from the panorama to focus on this specific young man. But there are traces throughout the novel, as you've observed, of general observation and trying to give him an environment. There's a milieu from which his particular form of religious conviction arises, and it's the somewhat, well, more than somewhat, the distinctly desolate city of New Prospect, which has a few hopeful prospects in it. One of those cities with a sort of gutted downtown, the old movie marquees standing as a testament to a once thriving pedestrian life, all that. It's all in the book, and pretty specifically, I realized that I couldn't tell it only from Ahmad's point of view when I began to try to describe New Prospect, because I had to kind of use a vocabulary that I didn't think would occur to him. So the book, which began as a first-person novel, wound up as a third-person one.
Really? So the original draft of this was first-person?
It wasn't a full draft. I got as far as page 30 with the first-person, and it has a kind of intensity, the first-person. It's a tempting way to tell a novel, but it has the disadvantage in that the you only know what the hero or heroine knows, and also you do know that since they're telling you the story in some manner, they're still alive. Mm-hmm. So one of your major issues of suspense has been taken from you.
Yeah.
And there's the general worry about how is this being told. Catcher in the Rye is a psychiatric session, it would seem, a kind of very prolonged one, as is Portnoy's complaint. Other books take the form of letters being written by the first person, but I really think the major voice of the novel is the third person, where the author roams from head to head, gets a variety of viewpoints and impressions to create some kind of image of the society.
Well, a few reviews have kind of, speaking of this Jack Levy character, they've argued that you haven't been as sensitive to Ahmad in the sense that you've sort of split the difference. But I did actually a page count, and I saw that you pretty much kind of divided it between Jack Levy and Ahmad fairly equally. So it's like this dichotomy. And then also, you know, it seems to me that there's like a lot of comparison and contrast going on with these two sort of characters. But I'm wondering, though, if Jack Levy was in some sense kind of a reliable character for you to sort of come back to, because it was Ahmad is sort of real, you know, you were sort of suggesting that there were challenges here with his character. Was he kind of a way for you to sort of devote your attentions to Ahmad? Maybe you can talk about this.
Jack Levy is a reasonable, middle-aged, maybe more than middle-aged man, and I could maybe enter into his thoughts more easily than into Ahmad's. I didn't mean him, though, to be an alternative hero. I saw him as a supporting actor, not as the main actor. Ahmad, to me, is a dynamic. Faith makes him dynamic. It also makes him vulnerable. And he is young, so he doesn't have the range of reference. He doesn't have the past experience that Jack Levy has. If I really did balance the book exactly between the two, it was an aesthetic mistake, because I meant the main focus to be on Ahmad. But, yeah, it all came down to a kind of encounter between the two of them. So in a way, it's not entirely wrong that so much space is devoted to Jack, and also that the sense of fatigue, of exhausted possibilities, which is true of the city itself, is also true of his attitude toward his job and toward the students that he's supposed to guide. He is a guidance counselor, let's not forget.
Well, there's also a sort of, you know, he's not good with computers, and Ahmad sort of has this, you know, kind of really different sort of way of not kind of fitting in too. And there's also a sort of kind of comparative redemption that both of them sort of experience as well. Did these similarities kind of crop up as you were writing? Did you design them, or how did this actually come about? Are they intended as a sort of comparative sort of, you know, two qualifiers that we're to look at for you to sort of focus on these kinds of observations that run rampant throughout the book?
I think I knew from early on, once I had any kind of grip on the novel, that it would end with a dialogue, a discussion, an exchange of views, and in a way an exchange of life stories that would, to use your word, be reconciling or conciliatory. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give away any more of the ending than we already have, but yeah, I saw a kind of rapprochement between these two very different American males as the objective toward which the book was trending.
But again, going back to this idea of you sort of just really kind of, there are all these observations that just burgeon in this book that, you know, I haven't really seen from you in a long time. There's, for example, a lot of symbols throughout this book. You have the furniture store, you have truck driving, there are these great sort of images of Americana that just are in this book and so explicit, more so than what I think, you know, more so than anything I've seen since Rabbit at Rest. And I guess, again, going back to one of my earlier questions about whether you had sort of 5 years of observations or thoughts, or this was a way for you to, you know, maybe you can explain perhaps why this book was the perfect sort of novel for you to sort of kind of siphon all of these various kinds of things. I got the sense reading this, like, you know, Updike's like, hey, back in my day, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there may be a lot of that in it, a sense of deterioration or a change, and the older you are, the more you are apt to be prey to these feelings of deterioration in your environment, and certainly America has changed quite a lot since I was a child, just in terms of feeling crowded. Population when I was being taught at an elementary school was 140 million. Now it's close to 300 million, so it's doubled and a little more. There were vacant lots. There was still a sizable rural presence in every small town. The town I grew up in, and this was in the East, not in the Midwest, was surrounded by cornfields. There was a clip-clop of horse-drawn wagons occur on our street. Very sweet sound. The milk used to be delivered in a horse. So there's been a big turnover, much more pressure, a kind of hurry, and a kind of callousness perhaps that goes with the crowding. Rats, enough of them are crowded into a certain space, they'll begin to eat each other. And at times in urban America, you feel we've reached that point where we're beginning to eat each other. There also was a kind of national consensus that prevailed during World War II. I was 9 when Pearl Harbor was attacked, and 13 on VJ Day. So it was a rather brief war compared to some we've had since. But it was the 4 years that dominated my life, and I've never quite lost that feeling of national solidarity, pride in the U.S., belief that we could do no wrong. Basically, we were on God's side, as Joe Lewis said at the time, and everybody contributed. As a kid, you saved tin foil and jumped on tin cans and used war stamps. So yes, this isn't that world. Now we're on the wrong side. We are the great Satan. They are on God's side, and that, I guess if I had a point about terrorism, it's their belief that they are righteous and in the right, and by combating us with everything they've got, every dirty and savage trick they have, that they are fulfilling God's will. And so it gives them a great force, a great momentum, a fury that's very hard to quell, and very bewildering to the American people, who are used to being thought of as good guys. We supply the world's popular culture to a great degree. We supply much of the aid that countries in varying degrees receive. We've become, by default, since the Cold War, the world's policemen, and we're getting rather little thanks for it. Instead, we're getting 9/11 and subsequent and previous attacks, and a quagmire in Iraq and a lesser quagmire in Afghanistan. So these are not such happy times to be an American.
But to some extent, that doesn't necessarily reflect the American people, who form a very sort of, I think, positive presence in this book. Without giving anything away in the ending, there are the two girls. There is that family that sort of sits down in the pew. There is a definite sort of humanism that sort of flows throughout this book that seems almost at odds with the kind of atmosphere that you're sort of describing here, and also this wistfulness that you're describing here. So I guess, I don't know, I mean, perhaps these values that you're describing might be reflected more through people as opposed to the sort of, you know, overarching sort of things that we don't necessarily have control of, you know?
So it's interesting that you link the two black children in the Volvo station wagon ahead of him with those kids in the church pew when he ventures into. And there's no doubt that his rigid creed, which he's learned from the imam, is in the process in this novel of being softened by actual experience. His episode with Joraline is another softening. Mm-hmm. So that he's not quite the same, as he himself recognizes, he's not quite the same faith-driven person we meet on the first page as he becomes something else, and in a way something less on the last page.
But I guess, though, it seemed interesting to me because there has been a little bit of a pessimism I've observed in your works in the last 20 years, and this one, there was, even despite your criticisms of like where culture is going, there is still this kind of blossoming of people, of humanism, that really sort of, you know, serves as a kind of, you know, way for people who are particularly rigid to change.
Exactly. How true and how American I'd like to think that is. Yes, one of the changes I've noticed in the world, America, the country as it is, compared to the country I grew up in, is that we are more tolerant, more diverse, more open to other people. It was really a very racist, prejudiced world that nurtured me. I didn't realize it till I had left it, put it behind me, but it was a tough world. It was a world of working men and women, and there wasn't an awful lot of mercy. And when the Depression hit, there was very little mercy from the government because the government didn't know how to cope with this kind of disaster. So pessimism, yes, but also a great, you've got it, a belief in the American way and a belief in the average person or the ordinary person. I think that people are much more, and look at the attitudes toward gays, as they're now called. When I was a kid, they were really off limits and just the butt of jokes, and nobody ever knew any. There was the other, and quite a lot of the other, far the other, and now...
Christopher Hitchens wrote an essay about the blowjob in this month's Vanity Fair.
The blowjob as an artifact,
as an American
sexual
symbol,
event,
too.
As a sexual event. Yes, it does seem to mean more to Americans than to other nationalities. I wrote a little essay about the blowjob, too, the blowjob in literature, which you can find in a book called, I think, Picked Up Pieces. It was one of the few pieces of criticism, literary criticism, that I've done with no prospect of a market, no prospect of selling it. But I was enough interested, the blowjob in Henry Miller, the blowjob in women's fiction. Erica Jong and various other women writers at last began to write about it, which was pretty hot stuff back in the early 60s.
Yeah. And now it's sort of, as Christopher Hitchens suggested, like a handshake. That's what he said. But it was a very, very strange essay. You should read this.
He also written about my book, which I have not read.
Oh, yes, either. The Atlantic piece. Yeah,
he's a man of opinions. but in my last novel called Villages, there is a bit of fellatio that is almost as friendly and innocent as a handshake. You're right.
Got you, but you were there a few years before him, so.
Right.
I
want my credit for getting ahead of
the first blowjob, the first literary blowjob essay. Okay. So from blowjobs to actually, I want to talk about the whole nature of the September 11th novel and how this has become sort of a scarce kind of genre, so to speak, within the literary genre. Jay McInerney wrote, of course, The Good Life, and he was advised by Norman Mailer to wait 10 years before writing it. He, again, of course, proceeded to write it anyway. And you wrote, actually, in a New Yorker review of Jonathan Safran Foer's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, that a little more silence, a few fewer messages, and less graphic apparatus would have permitted Foer to have an effect. And given Mailer's admonishment and also Foer's loudness, I'm wondering if you think it's too soon for fiction to dwell upon how terrorism and homeland security affect our lives. I mean, if these issues must be dealt with quietly, and we're, you know, it's very difficult to do that with them in recent memory, how can contemporary fiction do justice to the topic? Or is this where you come in?
There's a certain beauty in Norman Mailer in his 80s advising any other writer to wait 10 years. We may not have 10 years. I don't want to wait 10 years, certainly, to tackle a subject that interests me. This is not a 9/11 novel, mine. It's true, it's mentioned, and at one point the hero and a friend, another father figure, view the site of where the World Trade Center towers were, and they talk briefly about it. But it's about the post 9/11 world and its edginess and its very real background of atrocities. The atrocities have, to a large extent, except for 9/11, been abroad, but they seem very close. Abroad isn't near as far away as it used to be. Mm-hmm. And if they do a job on London and on Madrid, it seems almost a matter of time before there is another incident. It doesn't take much, after all, to create a terrorist sensation if you're willing to die. Imagine what two men with machine guns could do in almost any American mall. Before you stop them, they could kill quite a few shoppers and otherwise innocent. Well, I guess shopping is not a sin yet. Innocent people. So
depends on your theory of shopping being a sin.
That's right. It depends on your attitude toward shopping and toward malls. I don't think we need wait any longer. I think 5 years, more or less, or exactly, really, isn't it? They're pretty close. It'll be 5 years in a few months, and it's long enough for the experience to have sifted down into art. There was a play, I believe, about roughly an affair in which the man's wife died in the World Trade in the collapse, and I think you will get more rather than less of this kind of thing, where it really entered into people's lives and made a difference.
Are you referring to the Neil LaBute play? Or?
Yeah, is that right?
Neil LaBute did this really bizarre sort of thing where this guy, or maybe it may not have been a wife, I'm thinking of another one, but he did this really bizarre sort of play where, because there's this weird morality that works throughout Neil LaBute's work, and he essentially sort of had this character who missed an appointment to have an affair. That's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't go to the World Trade Center that morning, and he had an affair instead. And this play is all about his sort of guilt for this particular.
Sounds familiar. Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry, I got the plot wrong.
I don't know. I mean, maybe
I don't live
play.
In New York, and I don't see plays. But yeah. I was just trying to think of 9/11 as a object of artistic consideration. No, I think there's even more to come. But even if there were not, the atmosphere we live in now under the Bush administration. I think we can't help but write about it, the kind of America, Clinton's America and Lyndon Johnson's America are gone, and we have to deal with the world as it is. Increasingly, increasingly, of course, there may be less and less of a thing called the American novel because the globalization has made it possible for Americans to hop about quite a lot, and hard to know where America ends and the world beyond America begins. So a novel called The Coup, which I think you just mentioned a while ago, was certainly an attempt to write a global novel in a kind of, I guess, lighthearted way, again, about Arab anti-American feeling, Muslim anti-American feeling, and to show that the world is the stage. There's nothing less than the world, and America's role in it is... I guess my theory was is that in even the remote and hostile country of Kush, the U.S. is in the middle of Kush, and there was something about everybody being an American under the skin, that is the pop culture, the songs, the kind of aspirations and the sort of acceptance of sensuality. And the extremist Islamic movement is very much an attempt to turn back that particular tide and reject all the works and morality or lack of morality of the great Satan.
Well, I wanted to actually, you had mentioned Johnson there, and I wanted to sort of talk about a portion of your book, Self-Consciousness, on Not Being a Dove, where you wrote then about Vietnam and how you were embarrassed to be out of step with your editorial and literary colleagues on the anti-war continent. And you chronicled how you defended Johnson at Martha's Vineyard in front of Roth and several others.
Oh, really? Did I mention Roth?
Yeah, you did. You did. But in this book, you are really, really hard on this Homeland Security Secretary who bemoans that he won't be collecting speaker's fees or a lucrative book advance. And I wanted to ask you, would you describe yourself as a dove today, or does your essay require an update, of any kind? Or does this kind of book kind of, you know, respond to the fact that maybe in light of these circumstances you may have become possibly more dovish? Or is contemporary fiction the sort of synthesis to kind of combine all of these varying sort of, you know, I guess, opinions and feelings you have sort of sifting around?
I went to college and emerged with the idea that politics didn't much matter. This was in the early 50s. I graduated in 1954, and we were going to dedicate ourselves to the artistic life and the domestic life, have a lot of babies and write a lot of books or paint a lot of paintings, and that was all that really mattered, that politics was just noise, basically, noise in the background. Vietnam made it impossible to regard it as background noise, and I was embarrassed to find myself more conservative than many of my literary peers and my friends, and even in the small town where I lived. I was found myself rather shrilly and ineptly trying to say that the world is a jungle, the communists are out to get us, Johnson is trying to do a good thing here, and to complain about it so vigorously is to like throwing rocks at firemen who are trying to put out a fire, which was happening in many of the slums across the country at the same time. Now I'm older and even less inclined to develop a political view at all. I think our entry into Iraq the second time, I was certainly for the first Iraq invasion. I did not think countries should be allowed to take over their weaker neighbors just because they wanted to. And when the question of the oil reserves of Kuwait and Iraq was in question, I thought, and of course the other countries agreed, it was a UN action, though the U.S. Took the lead. Here we could find few other countries willing to go along with us, and it would seem that some of our information was incorrect. Saddam Hussein was an ugly customer, but he didn't seem to have weapons of mass destruction. So in a way, he was no threat, and the whole thing might have been a mistake. It certainly was not as easy to set up a democracy in Iraq as Cheney and all the thinkers in the administration seemed to feel. On the other hand, I guess I'm an undove in that I don't see that we can just beat a quick retreat and say, good luck, Iraqis, of that in a way, having stirred up the hornet's nest, we have to stick it out a little longer. And I still have some hope that I can't believe that the bulk of Iraqis don't want to just get on with their lives, and that the insurgents in their mad killing sprees of more and more their own fellow Muslims, I can't believe that they attract more than a tiny bit of support. So it's not really like Vietnam, where you could argue that after years of colonialism, the Vietnamese were ready to try something else. I think the Iraqis would be happy to see our experiment succeed, and they're angry in large part because it hasn't conspicuously succeeded. The U.S. has not proven to be a very inept occupying, very skillful occupying power. So that's where I stand on Iraq insofar as I have a position at all. I think, mistake or not, we're sort of stuck with it. It's like a China shop that advertises, if you break it, you own it. So we broke it, we own it.
But, I mean, you know, where does contemporary fiction come in to sort of do you think, you know, I mean, there's certainly kind of – okay, so you've identified Terrorist as not being a September 11th novel, but there is a sort of political undercurrent in the sense of what you decide to observe, the way you sort of feature keys kind of splayed out and how it's sort of really – that kind of imagery sort of evokes exactly what we have sort of sacrificed. I mean, you when you did research for this book, you learned that X-rays actually photograph in full color as opposed to black and white. And
you know, and I still don't, frankly, understand how they work. I can never find an article anywhere to explain exactly what is happening. Hmm. But you say with some authority that it's a photograph, it's a color photograph of the inside of a suitcase.
It's sort of like an MRI where you have like a sort of color kind of, you know, thing. I mean, you could when you go through the airport line, you could sort of look around and see that there's like a little bit of a color screen. It's not so occluded from your view, but. But yeah, I mean, you describe, for example, there's the whole section where you describe all the varying colors on the spectrum that is in the X-ray machine.
It's a beautiful sight in a way. I have often looked or peeked because they don't really encourage you to stand there and admire the contents of suitcases as they go through. But yes, it's an interesting art project, I would think, to have a series of interesting X-rays and the way the contents emerge in this quite lurid color. So, yeah, it was one of the features of the post 9/11 world, isn't it? The getting your suitcases X-rayed. It's hard. It's hard to find the technology explained because there's a sort of secretiveness. Certainly, it's hard to find much on the internet about how to make a bomb. I had to kind of concoct one for my plot and. Really, they kind of didn't tell you much. I read a book about Timothy McVeigh's bomb at Oklahoma City and kind of went from that. But maybe I was exceptionally ignorant and maybe somebody like Tom Clancy should have written this book instead. Except I wasn't trying to write really a Tom Clancy book or an especially political book. I was interested basically in the mindset of a fully convinced and ardent Muslim young man who is willing to become a warrior in the jihad and as such to lay down his life for this cause.
Got it. Well, I want to actually move from war to a question actually that I've been wanting to actually, you know, if I ever got a chance to talk to you, ask you for quite some time. With every one of your books, there contains this particular sort of moment, this phrase that you often use, what I call sort of the Updike sort of what the hell moment, where basically the sort of sexual imagery circumvents the character's needs and yet also kind of fulfills them. And I'll offer actually three examples here to kind of give you a sense of what I'm talking about.
Go ahead.
So from The Witches of Eastwick, in an early moment you have Alexandra cooking and you write, "Picking the watery orange-red orbs, Alexandra felt she was cupping a giant lover's testicle in her hands." From Rabbit Redux, you have when Harry is getting it on with Jill, you note of Jill's breast, "Their role is to haunt this house like two bleached creatures on a television set entertaining an empty room." And in Terrorist, I knew it was going to come in Terrorist, and exactly on page 159, you write of Beth's breasts,
Beth's two, he could remember, had been like inverted bowls, the size for breakfast cereal, with nipples hard as a single blueberry in his mouth. Now, obviously, these three passages are certainly quite striking, both in language and intent. But I think, though, the thing that actually I wanted to ask you about is that they have the appearance of coming from these characters' sort of sexual desires, and yet the imagery sort of goes into this kind of exterior kind of mode, this visual mode, as opposed to dwelling upon, I guess, the sort of, you know, using your gift for language to dwell upon the miasma of their lust or their love or their passion. And I have always wanted to ask you why you have decided to go for this kind of exterior approach of anatomy as opposed to sort of dwelling deep upon the sort of the passion of the sort of, you know, the there was a great thing that comes to mind is Michael Chabon's The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, where he describes like bullion balls in the chest, or you know. But I mean, I'm wondering though why you, in these particular instances, and it always happens in every one of your novels, that you don't actually apply this kind of this imagery to what is going on internally within the characters. Maybe you can sort of comment upon this.
Oh well,
I know it's a very unusual question, but it's ever since I've read you, you know.
It's an intricate question, yeah. And one that leaves me slightly defenseless. So why do I do these things? I mean, interior, internal, external, by giving a specific physical referent, the nipples that are like blueberries in breakfast cereal and so on. I don't know. I'm just making it real to myself and slightly absurd, I suppose. There is something absurd about sex in a way. But on the other hand, we are learned from the psychology and from our own experience that it's sexual images are never very far from our consciousness, that we look at each other as sex objects to a greater or lesser degree, especially the male gaze, the much deplored male gaze. And so these things well up very naturally, it seems to me. Certainly in my prose, they well up fairly naturally. I don't remember thinking as I was writing those phrases, I was doing anything especially notable. And in the characters' stream of consciousness also. We're all, influenced by this and that as the generations cycle around, and Molly Bloom's soliloquy in Ulysses, with also a kind of, at places, laughably concrete sexual imagery, influenced me and seemed to me a pretty good representation of life as it is, insofar as words can approximate, and they can only approximate the actual stream of our thoughts and impulses. Once you've established these physical parts, maybe you've implied the love state or whatever it is that you would like to see instead. Sex is so prevalent that you can convey it in all sorts of ways, and the Victorians didn't need very specific images. In Tolstoy, though, you especially, but among others, you don't doubt the sexuality of these people. No, you feel it very strongly, maybe more strongly where it was still veiled. It was a veiled process that wasn't described or discussed except in pornography, whereas now I and others of my generation try to weave sex into the normal flow of experience and thought.
But I guess the question, though, is impulse versus external imagery, and why you choose the latter. You know what I mean?
How do you describe an impulse, though, really, except by suggesting it or implying it? There's certain things, many things, that language can't do. What it can do is make pictures, and these pictures are meant to form a reflection of lived life. Mm-hmm. So that I can't help it that I think in images, and some of them are overly specific or ridiculous. But of course, the people have emotional feelings, if that's your question, and they have loving feelings. as well as conflicted feelings. Sex isn't entirely an ice cream sundae. It also is prunes and bitter almonds and all kinds of things.
Well, they do. They do have feelings. And my question is why the language isn't applied to their feelings. I mean, is this kind of what you're talking about, where the risk of language, when you convey such feelings, that you will have perhaps an overly sort of sentimental novel? Is it sincerity that is the issue here? Or is it sort of like when you dwell in realism, as you do, you can't maybe there's a certain risk in actually portraying feelings as they are through imagery. Is this an issue perhaps?
It might be an issue, but I can't quite grasp it. All I feel is that my job is to tell stories and tell them often through images, and the images arise out of my own thoughts they are impulses that my impulse in these sentences you name was to be as specific and to be as fresh in the metaphor as I could. I think I set off a reaction in you that I never foresaw in any reader.
Well, that's certainly true. I did read one of those when I was 14 or 15, so it did get me thinking a little bit. But this kind of talks – this also brings up another question about – this kind of concerns Nicholson Baker's book-length essay, You and I. He sort of describes the way that he becomes sort of obsessed with specific phrases, dwelling in particular on vast dying sea. Now, I got a similar sort of sensation with the phrase in Terrorist, chalk-faced goth, because it seemed – so utterly specific in the way that chalk and goth don't quite rhyme, and yet to the untrained ear, they almost might rhyme. And that kind of is interesting in light of the fact that goths have kind of are sort of, they have no sense of history, they have no sense of, they have no real idea of, like, you know, the architecture or the literary romances of the 19th century. I'm wondering, what kind of work do you do to come up with a specific phrase like that? Do you consult a thesaurus? Do you often try out, like, hundreds of combinations to get such a phrase right? Maybe you can describe how this is, or is it entirely instinctive by now?
Well, I certainly didn't try out hundreds of combinations, and just trying to make it vivid what the goths looked like. Yeah. I see them in kind of vampire makeup, and they weren't around when I was in high school. A lowly instinctive protest of making yourself ugly perhaps was still there, but by and large, American high schools have become equipped with whole new classes of students, including the ones who parade a kind of macabre and chalk-faced. They're vampires, you know, Dracula, they're all chalk-faced to me. So I didn't really mean too much for that phrase, just trying to bring them into a kind of reality. The novel is not so much an anatomy of a modern inner-city high school, but it does take off from that, and I wanted to make it a kind of momentarily vivid environment, housing, among other oddballs, this self-converted, white-shirted, black-jeaned convert to Islam.
Well, but specifically, though, the question is kind of pertaining to the language that we're kind of talking about, not just necessarily the descriptive. How does chalk and goth kind of come into play when you sit down at the typewriter to, you know,
as an old light verse writer, I don't reject these occasional rhymes or near rhymes as they occur in language. I think you have to take language as it comes, and undoubtedly language does have abstract qualities, which in rhyming, for example, and alliteration are brought to the fore. Mm-hmm. So I maybe do use alliteration and consonants and so on now and then just to inject a note of play into the prose. I see prose as translucent more than transparent. That is, we're aware of it as we read. We do not think that we're in a high school or a New Prospect or burning Moscow or anything. We know we're sitting in a chair or reading a book, so that there's no reason for the language to run and hide or try to run and hide, but you try to make it thin enough and transparent enough so that the reader forgets to a large degree that he's reading language and is really reading images, images and feelings. So, yeah, a little vividness. Ulysses, to name one book, is full of this kind of wordplay. And I think within limits it has its place in good prose.
I want to talk about your Book Expo America address, where you railed against a Kevin Kelly article and which described the growing movement to make books accessible through digital conduits. And you took particular umbrage with the notion of access to the author, as well as text being sliced and diced up like some sort of hip-hop mix of some kind. But I wanted to present to you, as a sort of online proponent, isn't there room for both of these ideas? First of all, who wants to sort of read a 300-page novel on a screen, on a monitor? It's just I can't think of a single person who would want to do that. Certainly, you know, also, an online excerpt from Terrorist might actually work to get people interested in actually buying your book. So I guess, you know, is it the access to the author thing that you were taking offense to? Maybe we can talk about this. I want to, you know, let you know that there's a whole sort of, I guess, literary kind of culture that is also available online. This podcast, I suppose, is part of that. And I
seem to be cooperating with it.
Yeah.
I'm sleeping with the enemy, so to speak. Well, there is a whole world of internet and exchange that I'm not a part of, and I'm an old fogey and missing out on a lot because of it. The Kelly article was striking because of its visionary tone, and in place of the purchased 300-page novel with a signed author and a lone consumer in his chair, his or her chair, you had a kind of hard-to-visualize ocean of words, word snippets, this and that, flowing back and forth, everybody kind of their own writer, no copyright around to inhibit anybody. I couldn't see it. I couldn't see that this was art or capable of real communication. It seems to me to be a kind of self-advertisement, rather, on the part of the users of this. And when he came to talk about ways in which the writers of the future might make a living, it came down, surprisingly, to this very primitive notion of personal access and the writer himself being there, engageable in conversation. Mm-hmm. How can that be? I mean, how thin can a writer spread himself to the point where he's making money out of this? And wasn't the whole point of writing that by sitting alone in a room and chiseling your words and trying to make them sing and sting and provoke thought that the writer was communicating and was giving a kind of personal access through the miracle of the printed and reproduced word I couldn't imagine the substitute. It's a little like not being able to imagine the world for which the suicide bombers are fighting. What will it be like? Where is this? Where is this paradise? The digital revolution needs no advocacy, really. It's just something that is happening. It's a fact. And it's hard to read any long text, I would think, on the computer. My wife has a computer with internet access, and the print is tiny. Right there, you have almost a kind of age distinction, and that is made for young eyes and made for young young thoughts in a way, too. It's quick and slapdash and hippie and slangy and abbreviated and a far removed from the kind of thing that I was taught to revere when I was a student of English.
Well, but it's also an inroads to some degree. I think there's like a happy medium between the so-called, I object myself to, you know, MySpace, for example. I can't possibly look at a MySpace page, and I'm an online guy. But I think your point here is more, you're sort of taking umbrage with more of the marketing aspect of the author now having to make more personal appearances, having to do more interviews, is this the kind of access to the author that you're sort of objecting to, where it doesn't necessarily stand based off of the work, not everyone these days, an emerging author today, can't pull a J.D. Salinger or a Thomas Pynchon. He must go out there and promote his book. He must go out there and work out so you'll look good on the author cover. Is this perhaps what you were kind of objecting to more so?
Yes, yes. I would object to all those trends, yeah. And I even object to my own my own being here talking into the microphone to you. I mean, I'm trying to do my best, yeah. And I've even developed a certain fluency in interviews, but I don't feel that the opinions which I come up with under the pressure of an immediate question, yes, that the opinions are worth really an awful lot in the great scale of things. I see them as a lesser emanation of my presence on the earth than the written works over which I've labored and over which editors have to some extent labored and that are as perfect and as polished as one can make them. What we have been substituted for that is conversation, which we already had, after all, in the form of actual face-to-face confrontation. What has the electronic revolution done except to expand the distance with which you can have a conversation? My grandfather used to sit on the sofa and talk to his other old cronies about, what, the past and developments in local politics and that kind of thing. And I was trying to, in my own career, get beyond that into somehow making verbal artifacts that can last.
But certainly, like, you know, some kind of initial response to the works that are out there is valuable. Some criticism is valuable. And what's happening now with a lot of newspapers is that we're seeing book review sections either diminish or disappear altogether. And I suppose perhaps some of that kind of, I guess, more thoughtful and actually correctly sort of spelled kind of criticism might actually make a transcendence to these kind of online venues. I mean, wouldn't that be good? I suppose. I mean, certainly people need to, you know, when an Updike book comes out, they need to sort of think about it, you know.
I'm glad.
Well, I hope so.
I'm glad they should think about it. And of course, insofar as an excerpt on the web or whatever is an advertisement for the book, I can't complain any more than I could complain about ads for the book that appear in newspapers. I just wonder what it will do to the quality of writing and of thought, indeed, when everything is basically chit-chat, when there is the library in Alexandria was one of the themes of Mr. Kelly, yeah, in his arresting vision of the future, and to what extent is the Library of Alexandria a big chat room? It's wonderful that this power of electronic communication and words that get on a screen and zip 1,000 miles in less than a second, all that is clearly delightful to people, to young people especially. Yes, it has a magic to it that everything electric does. But I just had trouble visualizing exactly how the world of the future as you saw it would work. I was addressing, after all, booksellers, another profession like that of the book writer, caught in a kind of time warp in which the way we were used to dealing and making a livelihood are being blithely dismissed as no longer necessary.
I don't know about that. I mean, books are still around. I mean, you know, there are bookstores. We've got plenty of bookstores here in San Francisco. Your book has come out here. I don't think the book is showing any sort of sign of, you know, becoming extinct anytime soon.
That's comforting to hear, and that's what I say when I'm asked about is the book dead. I always say no, that I think people, that the advantages of the book as an artifact and as a way of packaging words will make it continue for a while. You still see people reading, but the reading print as a hot medium, I think, is over. I think in the 19th century it was a hot medium. It was a way of carrying the latest news in a way. And in the novel especially, these softly worded descriptions of actual human behavior were news and educational even to people in a way that has passed to other forms. Once the movies came in a way, the doom, the bells of doom were beginning to strike, and the cinema and its spin-offs remains really the most formidable rival to the written narrative, because it's a totally other way of telling a story, and more immediate, more easy to absorb, and in a way more irresistible than the book. The book is handy, and in a handy way can always be picked up, but it can just as easily be put down. And it's much harder to walk out of a movie than it is to put down a book. So yes, I think for a while at least, and maybe for a long while, everything will coexist. There will be books in bookstores, and there also will be a lot of people huddled over their computer screens talking to each other and absorbing information in the fluid form of word snippets. I was struck, by the way, my daughter asked me for a birthday present for a copy of the Columbia Encyclopedia, which I have one and have had several editions of. And I went to the local bookstore and offered to buy it. It must cost about $100 or so. I reasoned this would be a nice order for my, encourage my local bookseller, and I was told that no way can they order it, that there is no more, basically, Columbia Encyclopedia. It's been taken over by the encyclopedias on what's it called, the Internet? Anyway, it was a shock to me, a shock to think that things such, so institutional and so useful and so well arranged should be abruptly dismissed from the armory of educational tools.
Well, I shall do my duty right now because another journalist has walked in, and as the Internet sort of spokesman, I shall bid you adieu. John, it's been a pleasure.
You're full of new ideas and more power to you.